known to the TechNet enthusiasts. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and for those who are curious radio amateurs who want to make an advancement in their knowledge of how radio works, how wireless equipment works, how to make the equipment work better, hopefully you're in the right place. This TechNet has been around for 31 years. This is TechNet number 1475 of the series that began way back in 1972. So if you're curious, you want to know more, you're in the right place. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City area, and those guys gather and teach each other. Not all the TechNets are interesting. Some of them are boring. Some of them are interesting. The subjects that are discussed are the subjects that you bring as questions or comments. So if you think it's boring, well, then you haven't been contributing what you think are interesting questions. And even in the best of all situations, a person maybe is hearing material that he has heard before, he already knows about it, and he's bored by it. That's understandable. And if he listens long enough, he'll find some things that he hasn't heard. And there's a solution to that. By way of that beautiful website that was assembled by Mike Perry, KC2NJI. You go there, you go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And there the last 6.5 years of technical nets are recorded. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week. Download those recordings. And that way you can listen to past TechNets. Well, you can listen to the TechNet that you think was partially boring and partially interesting by recording it and fast-forwarding through the sections you don't want to listen to. That's about the way you used to use your videotape recorder in the old days. You would fast-forward through the boring scenes and get to the good scenes, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So that's one of the solutions to that. Over the 31 years, the evolving technical net, it's continuously evolving, used to start off as 1 hour's worth, then 2, 3, and now it's 4 hours worth. It starts at 8 o'clock and ends at midnight. Because the machine gets turned off at midnight, at my request, because there are guys that are... It's good that we assembled enthusiastic guys with a lot of curiosity, but there's a limit. Some of us have got to go to work the next day, and it's got to stop somewhere. So by the machine automatically turning off at midnight, that happens. Let me drop. We should all try to wait for the 4 beeps plus 1 or 2 seconds beyond to make sure that all of the system becomes reset, because lately we're discovering there's a significant number of people who are dialing into the TechNet by way of Echo Link, IRLP, other kinds of interconnecting techniques, and for all of that system to be reset, some extra timing is required. Otherwise, the guys in the hinterland will be complaining to us that, I got timed out, and I didn't hear everything beyond the first half hour. So we want to try to avoid that. The Evolving Technical Net has a menu that we've evolved, and if you don't like the menu, suggest a better one. But the current menu is for the first hour or hour and a half, we take check-ins with people who do have a question or a comment for the net. You need that sign-in just to say that you're listening. After 31 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't take confirmation any longer. And I'm not going to ask that mysterious question, is there any emergency traffic? Everybody who runs a net of some kind always asks that question. Is there any emergency traffic? There never is, but they ask it anyhow. How in the world did that tradition get started? I don't know. We're not going to ask that question. But during the first hour, hour and a half, we try to give quasi-brief questions and answers to people. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who collects the mailbag information. For those who don't have a license yet or don't have the right equipment, not properly located, so they can give a reasonably snow-free signal into the repeater. For those people who have trouble getting in RF-wise to sign in live during the net itself, they send John an email, a snail mail, or a carrier pigeon message by one means or another, or hand deliver it to him in some cases. By one means or another, he gets messages. He chooses 2, 3, or 4 of those that have general interest, and we discuss those. Let me drop. That's followed by our space expert, Paul WS2N, who tells us the latest at what National Aeronautics and all these other organizations that are now giving aid to them, what they've been doing lately, what's going on in space. After that, after the first three menu items that I just mentioned, then we go into deeper subjects, which doesn't please everybody. Some people will say, gee, that's a section I really look forward to. A significant number of people say, no, I don't want to go there. And every so often I meet amateurs who don't have curiosity. I'm a little bit amazed by that. During the first 55 minutes or so, we also have the services of HAL, K6DPZ, who has a lot of experience in older pieces of equipment. So if you've got an older piece of equipment you want to know about, also HAL feels that he is at times able to give a more compact answer than I give. Sometimes my answers are pretty verbose. In the past, when I used to ask people as they sign in, do you want me to be brief or verbose? And they usually say, please be brief. Until you get to my particular subject, I want to hear everything about it. You can sort of see what's going on. So you can sort of get around that problem, as I said before, by listening to a recording and fast-forwarding to the sections you don't like. But we don't make up the subjects. 95% of what's discussed on the TechNet are the subjects you bring as questions. So at this time, we're going to take in check-ins. Let me drop.
That was only 8 minutes, Dick.
Does that mean I'm getting a little more brief? Sometimes it takes me, this so-called monologue takes a hell of a lot longer than that. You guys are going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. That means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KC2WGB, John, and yes. So give me your check-ins right now, K2LIW listening.
V2LIY, Joe, yes.
Okay, we got Joe. Some mysterious guy named Joe. We've never heard of him before. That's a joke, of course. A frequent sign-in. Anyone else to sign in tonight with the TechNet with a question or a comment? Give me a call letters and name right now.
QIT.
Okay, I heard only QIT. Give me the prefix of, sounds like Quebec Yankee Tango. Give me the prefix and your name, sir. Go right ahead.
Hello, Charlie 2, Papa Yankee Tango. This is Ed.
Very fine, Ed. Papa Yankee Tango, we got you that time. Alrighty. Give me the next check-in. Give me your call letters and name and the word yes that you do have a question or a comment. K2LIW listening.
KD2, Echo Whiskey Oscar Joe.
Echo Whiskey Oscar. Okay, we got you, Joe. And one last call. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
US 2, I'm with the space report. Good evening, Dick. Good evening, John.
And to extend, nothing specific for today, for tonight. There is a room after Paul to go to some thermogenetic intermagnetic resonance in copper and gases. And to extend.
6DP is Rich.
Okay, we got Paul, Wes, and Hal. Hal, were you about to make a statement? K6DPZ, K2LIW?
Yeah, just when they check in, if they want a quickie, let them at that time say they want a quickie. So at least you'll have an idea of, you know, who wants to be the longer answers and who wants to have the short answers.
Okay. So the two services that Hal serves is to give us more brief answers and to tell us about older pieces of ham radio equipment, which he has years and years of experience with. Joe, the B2LYY, what's the latest in your neighborhood? And wish I could talk you into putting up a tower. The B2LYY, K2LAW, you got it, Joe.
I'm not going to give a go there. Good evening, Dick. How you doing? W-H-Y-Y. This question might require a complex answer. Don't know. And then I have another question that should be not even related to this, which requires a very brief answer. Maybe I'll ask that one first, just to get that one out of the way. What object am I looking at in the southeast sky that is very, very brightly lit up right now? Then I'll get to my actual TechNet question.
I'm not positive, but I believe that's Venus. Anyone want to correct me on that? I think it's Venus that we're seeing. Go ahead.
I want to be in the east, Dick. Sorry, I meant to say southwest.
Maybe it's that satellite that's breaking up. Is it showing to be moving rapidly?
I think there's not a chance of that. So for the last few days, surveys of various people, particularly 2 days ago. It was very close to the moon in the western sky at sunset, or a little bit beyond sunset. Venus is a so-called inferior planet. In other words, its orbit is a smaller orbit than Earth and Mercury. The Earth that makes it inferior. So as such, you can see it at sunset or sunrise. You're never going to see it at midnight. And I believe that Venus is at its nearly its maximum brightness at this time. Anyone want to give me any further results of, is it Venus? Any of the real good astronomers on board, give us a call at us right now, K2LAW. Yeah, fairly sure it's Venus. And there are a number of websites you can go to. Heavens Above is one of them, among others, which will tell you what you're going to see after you tell them where you live. Give them a Latin long, give them a major city you're nearby or whatever. So there are a couple of websites that'll help. And when it comes to astronomical understanding, at times the people who like Sky and Telescope magazine or Astronomy magazine or the guys who own telescopes are always a little bit disappointed as to how little astronomical information their neighbors tend to have. Over to you, Joe, W-H-O-L-Y-Y. Go ahead with your real question, K-2-L-A-W.
Okay, I try to correct myself. Yeah, I meant to say southwest, not southeast. Okay, anyway, all right. That probably is correct here. That probably looks a little different. Okay, this has to do with an HF antenna, a dipole. In constructing a dipole and trying to tune it on the ground compared to its real height and reality, what it's going to be, what tends to happen with a dipole, and I'll give you an example in reality, an 80-meter dipole, strung between points that's typically about 25 to 30 feet up compared to tuning it very close to the ground. What will happen to the resonant frequency of that antenna as it's close to the ground? Back to you. Compared to when it's actually in its final, you know, resting place, so to speak. Back to you.
Let's give a quickie.
You got it, Al.
As it gets closer to the ground, dipole resonant frequency is going to be lower because you have more capacitance between the dipole and the ground. As you get up higher, its self-resonant frequency would be at a higher frequency. So it's hard to give an exact figure of how much change it would be unless you take two measurements on the ground at one level and another, and then you can do an approximation and graph it. Here's my quickie, K6DBZ. Very good, Hal. If you go to the appropriate page of the antenna handbook, the antenna book by ARRL, they show you a curve. No, it's not a curve, it's a graph. They show you a graph where the vertical axis is reactance, the horizontal axis is resistance, and on that graph you'll see a spiral. And the spiral has a whole bunch of marks along the spiral as to how many feet above the ground, correction, how many wavelengths above the ground that particular dipole is. So to discuss the resonant frequency of a dipole is only half the story here, as I see it, Joe, because resonance, one of the definitions of resonance is where you've made it longer or shorter, or you've added capacitance or inductance, you've done something so that the reactive component goes to zero. That's the usual definition of reactive, of resonance. However, your resistive component is changing simultaneously as a function of altitude. As such, the average guy, he doesn't really measure resonance. Yes, if he's using antenna analyzer, it might separately give him the reactive component and the resistive component. Very few guys do it that way. Let me drop. The average guy is using some kind of a standing wave ratio instrumentation, quite often a bird watt meter. He's looking at forward and reverse power. So as you change the altitude of the dipole above the ground, the resistive component and the reactive component are changing in this somewhat complicated manner that when it's plotted, it gives you the spiral. So until you get to the tuned altitude, in other words, you've decided that your dipole is going to be 73 ohms if you get it up to 80 feet of altitude. I'm just picking numbers out of the air. And everything below 80 feet of altitude, you're going to see higher visuar. Is a higher visuar a resistive mismatch or reactive mismatch? If the answer is yes, and some combination of them. So there's quite a bit going on. The dipole itself in free space, you can tell exactly what impedance is going to be, resistive reactive component, versus the dipole diameter, if it's high enough out up That's the so-called Brown and Woodward curves you've heard me say so often. But real dipoles, because 80 meters is such a darn long wavelength, to get a large number of wavelengths above the ground is not easy in 80 meters. Therefore, you're into that spiral curve if you want to know the next level of understanding. W2LYY, what does that make some sense, Joe? K2LYW?
Yes, Dick, it does start to make some sense. See, the reason I was asking this question is I eventually do want to apply this to reconstruct my 80-meter dipole, but also using the same points of support to incorporate within that dipole structure something that would handle 40 meters or possibly 20 meters. And I think I've asked this question before. The tuning of one band will possibly affect the other band. So that's what I'm sort of getting at. You can't really tune this thing with like 35 feet in the air or 30 feet in the air. They're very tough to get up that high and get to the ends of where each particular antenna would be. They trim it up to get it resonant to where you want it to be, to get it as close as possible. So I sort of have to do that with the center point being about maybe 5-6 feet above the ground and let the ends be supported, you know, normally where they're going to be supported. Back to you.
I see where you're going here, Joe. And when it comes to a multi-frequency dipole, there's at least three ways of doing it. Loading coils, what do they call it now, multi-V dipole. You can put 3, 4, 5 dipoles together by setting each one of them approximately the right length and connecting them all together. Fan dipole is what I was trying to think of. So each of them have got their own characteristics. The fan dipole, the 80-meter portion tends to be all by itself. If you're building a fan dipole, then when you're tuning the 80-meter section, it has essentially very little effect on the 40 and the 20. When you're adjusting the 40 and 20, it has really no effect on the 80, is my experience. On top of that, there are modeling programs there. When you take your particular antenna and model it, knowing approximately what the characteristics of your soil are, and you go to the right modeling program and tell it how far above the ground am I, what impedance am I going to see, and you can check, in other words, does the modeling program check when you're doing your tuning process up back in the ground, back in the backyard, and then depending on your confidence build up from that, you can say, okay, the modeling program is going to tell me what I'm going to get at, let's say, 80 feet if I'm able to go there. Let me drop, there's another section here. Once you build up, let me let it drop long enough. Once you build up confidence in that modeling program at your tuning altitude, let's say 10 feet off the ground, then you can use the modeling program to figure out what it's going to be at your real altitude, let's say at 60 feet off the ground. Once you know the exact impedance the antenna is going to be at 60 feet off the ground, you've got a couple of choices. You can go back to the modeling program, change the length and or zigzag and do other things to see if you can get a better impedance match. Or, once you know what the real predicted impedance is going to be, you then go to the Berkeley program. You simply Google the word B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, Berkeley plus impedance match. You do a search on that word combination. You'll get this beautiful program by Berkeley, where Berkeley will ask you what frequency you are, what's the impedance of your transmitter, resistive and reactive component, what's the impedance of your load, your antenna, resistive and reactive component. You fill in those 5 or 6 pieces of information, and you press go, and in 1 second, Berkeley will give you 15 solutions. And one of the solutions is the one you like the most, a particular inductor and a particular capacitor, just one inductor, one capacitor, mounted right at the antenna. Berkeley will tell you exactly how many microhenries and how many picofarad to give you a perfect impedance match to whatever your transmission line is, 72 ohm, 50 ohm, 80 ohm, 300 ohm, whatever, with one step at your favorite frequency. Yes, one band at a time. And now to make a multi-band version of that, that's also possible. Because in the case of a fan dipole, one last piece of info I'm going to give you. Let me drop. The beauty of a fan dipole is it does automatic switching. When you're on 80 meters, that 80-meter dipole is going to be something in the vicinity of 73 ohms. And if you're using 73-ohm transmission line, 99% of the power is going to go there. Your 40-meter dipole that's there at the same time is a huge reactance because it's way off resonance. Therefore, it's essentially an open circuit. And vice versa. When you go to 40 meters, the 40-meter dipole is going to be something like a 73-ohm impedance. The 80-meter dipole is going to be zillions of ohms of capacitor reactance, essentially an open circuit. Probably less than 1% of your 40-meter energy is going to go down the 80-meter dipole. So it automatically switches. Therefore, it is possible to make one of these Berkeley solutions with an inductor and capacitor, so to speak, on each one of those bands and bring it all together. I didn't say it's the right way to go, but it's possible. It's a little bit like building a duplex link filter, where you can combine two transmitters into one antenna. Or, again, people use a duplex link filter to have one antenna going into multiple receivers that are tuned to different frequencies. So there's ways around this. There's a zillion solutions. Your biggest problem is going to be, Joe, to choose the one that keeps you happier. However, you've got the resources, and you've got the patience to try one, two, three different solutions and see which ones you like. And keep us informed as you go down this road, Joe, because you've got a problem that a lot of people have had. W-H-U-L-Y-Y, T-2-L-A-W in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, the type of dipole I was going to try to make was not a fan dipole, which I guess you get some separation between the elements. I think I asked you about this one before, and I built a small bottle of this on much, much higher frequency band, and it seemed to work like you said it's supposed to be. I had planned to try to actually do something where everything is supported from more, actually two support points, and you know, where the elements are actually laying next to each other, but just simply at different lengths. I've never tried to do this before in actual construction on lower frequency UHF bands, but I am going to give it a good shot. But having the thing near ground proximity was starting to worry me as far as how much the tuning is going to be affected by, percentage-wise as they go between, like, as I said, where they balance like 4 or 5 feet, 6 feet above the ground compared to like 30 feet above the ground. Back to you.
Yeah, don't reject the fan dipole, Joe. It has the elegance of simplicity. And yes, at first it looks like it requires a zillion support points. There are guys who have built a fan dipole with only two support points. The main 80-meter portion of it goes directly to the support points. And then by catenary pieces of rope, the right and the length of rope can now support the 40, the 20, and the 15-meter dipole below the 80, so to speak. So you could have two support points even though it's a fan dipole. And the fan dipole is a little bit more predictable on what it's going to do on each one of the bands. It's a little bit more independent. These kinds of multi-trap type dipoles, which you've got a bunch of tuning structures throughout the piece of wire of the 80-meter dipole, the disadvantage of those is there's a lot of interaction. It's not very easy with one of those to independently tune the 20-meter section without interfering with the 80 and the 40-meter section, if you know what I mean. On each one of those bands, you've got a favorite frequency where you want it to work the best. And the independence of tuning of that fan dipole has got a lot going for it. Back to you for a final on this one, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Steve PZ with a comment.
Joe first, and then Hal in that order. Go ahead, Joe.
Let's see how Hal comments, and maybe you got something more to add, which I might be thinking about asking about anyway. Go ahead, Hal.
You got it, Hal.
You can make a multiband fan dipole using 5-conductor flatline control cable. Rotor control cable. It works very well. You cut each of the lines at different lengths to equal each resonant frequency. It doesn't have to fall we fan.
Yeah, I've seen those, and the good news is that it's one nice compact structure with that ribbon cable that we used to use on our rotators as the multi-elements with all of them individually cut. The good news is it's simple looking physically. The bad news is that there's a hell of a lot more interaction. Unless you're following somebody else's design, you're going to spend quite a bit of time tuning, because the 40-meter dipole and the 20-meter dipole are only a fraction of an inch away from the 80. There's going to be a lot of interaction, and therefore the amount of foreshortening is not easy to predict unless you're following somebody else's design. That's criteria number one. Criteria number two, because of the very close spacing and because every dipole has got extremely high voltage at the tip when it's running, you've got very high voltage across a fraction of an inch of spacing on relatively lossy rubber, because the rubber of the ribbon cable was not intended for RF purposes. It was intended to carry 60 cycle power to your rotator. As such, you're going to be getting some extra loss. Now, maybe that extra loss is only a dB, and maybe we shouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep about it, but it's something to concern yourself with, and there's a method by which you can find out exactly how much loss it's got. Let me drop. Question. Pick up the question in a second. The way you can find out exactly how much loss it's got, to the nearest of 10%, 20% accuracy, is you run the dipole at some reasonable altitude in the backyard, run a key down with 100 watts going into it for, let's say, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, turn up the transmitter and go over there and touch everything. And if there really is loss, it's got to get hot. And if it runs ice cold, then your particular rubber is great stuff, and don't worry about it. Person with a question, go ahead. Start off with your call letters and your name. My name is Dick.
Yes, Cal. This is for QRP up to about 35, 40 watts, not high power. That was my comment.
Glad you told me that. And the fact that you wouldn't recommend it to, let's say, at 100 watts or beyond, does suggest it's got some loss, and therefore you might burn up the rubber. Minor detail, but once you know about it, there's ways you can apply corrective action there. And that is a smarter person could then say, gee, the high voltage on the dipole is only at the tips. Therefore, I'll take this rivet cable and do a little bit of peeling back near the tips where the high voltage is. So now I'm creating a hell of a lot more air spacing between those sections, and maybe I can have the best of both worlds. And when you solve that problem, Joe, I want you to write an article on it. So K2LYY, K2LAW.
Well, what I was going to do is something like what Hal said, but it constructed out of something a little thicker material, a little thicker insulating properties out of the wire. And the second thing I was going to do is exactly what you just said about 30 seconds ago, was not let the wires, just cut them and let them sit like that at the end, but actually cut them a little bit and let the wire hang down slightly so the end is physically actually away from it, from the end of the wire itself as it's cut. And maybe I'll put something on.
Yeah, that's a good technique, Joe, and good luck with that. Okay, the next person on the list was Ed, KC2, Papa Yankee Tango. Go right ahead with your question, Ed, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. Wait for the four beeps.
Hello, everyone. My question has to do with a random wire antenna. First, can you just confirm that I'm coming through okay?
You sound beautiful, Ed. Please proceed.
Okay. I am in an apartment building in Queens, and I have, been clipping. So I've got a Yaesu 897, and I've clipped, for receiving purposes only, to the fire escape. And I've found that my fire escape is a fantastic receiver, and I've been able to pick up all kinds of stuff. Now, my thought was to use a random wire antenna for actual transmission purposes. And I ran out maybe 35 feet of wire and just dropped it out my window to see what I could get. And I was able to make a contact with a repeater on 10 meters somewhere in upstate New York. But while they reported that my transmission was coming through very clearly, on receive, it was extremely noisy, and I could barely hear them. And that was honestly the only thing I was able to pick up other than some CW signals, because everything on receive with this piece of wire was extraordinarily noisy. And I'm just wondering if you have any ideas on how I might be able to remedy that.
Yeah, living in a metropolitan area like Queens, New York City, there is a possibility on 10 meters there's a lot of local noise generating. Maybe the elevator system in the apartment building, the fluorescent lighting nearby in a parking lot, there's lots of things that create noise. One of the first things I would investigate, if you had the chance, as I see it, Ed, would be to look at the audio output of your receiver with an oscilloscope and synchronize the oscilloscope to the 60-cycle line. And you can be sure that you've done that correctly by simply grabbing the end of the scope probe with your finger. Your finger will pick up enough 60-cycle signal, and if the 60-cycle signal appears across the screen as a steady-state signal, you know you've got to synchronize the scope synchronized correctly. Many oscilloscopes will have something called line sync, where it's not synchronizing to the signal, it's synchronizing to the 60-cycle line. Once you set your scope that way, and you look at the noise coming out of the receiver, if you see a characteristic bunch of noise blobs that sit still when synchronized to 60 cycle, that would be a strong indication of the kind of noise you're getting locally, if that's what it is. Fluorescent lighting, for instance, goes on and off 120 times per second. It goes to complete extinguishing. Every time the line voltage goes through zero, a fluorescent light goes through zero. And a fluorescent light, let me drop, is an extremely good broadband noise generator. And if you've got a parking lot with a whole bunch of them nearby, or even some of the sodium lighting can also do that. Let me drop. So where that repeater reported that you're getting a nice signal into it and implies you've got a good antenna working well, a good path between you and it, and the fact that they're hearing you and you're not hearing them suggests local noise. There is another slim possibility, and that is every repeater, the transmitting frequency and the receive frequency are offset. They're offset by 600 KC on 2 meters, and I forget what the number is on 10 meters, but because there's a difference in transmit and receive frequency, you run into a very peculiar problem, and the usual way it shows up is a guy's got a handy-talkie, he knows he's kind of far from the repeater, so he walks around the room and handles the handy-talkie high, low, left, right, tilts it in various ways until he gets a pretty strong signal on reception. Then he goes with the handy-talkie and transmits back to the repeater, and they don't hear him. And I say, what's going on here? Let me drop.
W2YOI, what a question on that 10-meter repeater.
Okay, I'm going to repeat this thought. I'm going to complete this thought and then go over to you, Joe. And that is, because of that 600 KC of offset, because there's a zillion wavelengths, even though that frequency separation is very small, there's a zillion wavelengths between you and that repeater, and it starts ganging up. So the best position for your handy-talkie to get best reception from the repeater is not the best position for transmit. And if you do the duplex operation someday, in other words, by carefully locating a second handy-talkie far across the room, tuned to the repeater, and now you walk around with your handy-talkie while transmitting, you'll discover that there are certain positions in the room that give the strongest signal when you're transmitting to the repeater, and it's not necessarily the same position for reception. So your particular random wire antenna hanging off the fire escape, slim chance you run into that problem. I kind of doubt it. I think local noise is more likely. And there's various ways that you can drop another random length of wire, a little bit longer, a little bit shorter, mounted a little bit north or a little bit south on the fire escape, and see if the effect repeats. Good strong signal on transmit and lousy signal-to-noise ratio on reception. So there's a number of experiments along these lines, but the oscilloscope experiment, quite often, that really is an eye-opener. Let's see what Joe's got to say. So B2LYY, K2LAW, go ahead, Joe. Wait for the beep.
Good evening there. I believe there's one repeater in the New York City area that transmits tied and connected to a 10-meter repeater. I'm not sure what frequency you attune to, but this one I think is on 29.62, whereas 10-meter repeater transmitter is quite a bit ways upstate New York. But he has multiple receiving sites that he's tying back into that transmitting site through a voting system. And I think one of the receiving sites is possibly downstate in the metropolitan area, so that's possibly why they were receiving very good, but you couldn't hear the transmitter because the transmitter is many, many miles further away than one of the receivers is. Back to you.
Another very good point, Joe. I'm glad you brought that up. The so-called split site repeater. Yeah, I'm sitting here naively thinking that every repeater is using the same antenna for transmit and receive. A number of the more sophisticated repeaters will transmit out of one antenna, receive out of another, and sometimes those two sites are 30 miles apart. So give us the call letters and or frequency of the repeater that you are doing this experiment with, Ed. KC2, Papa Yankee Tango, K2LIW. Yankee Tango. You either changed location, changed position, changed transmitter, something. We only heard about four words that time, Ed. Want to try again? KC2 Papa Yankee Tango, K2LIW in the TechNet.
My apologies, KC2 PYC. I see the repeater that you mentioned being on 29.62. That was not the one I was using. I don't think that's the answer to it. to Dick. Actually, first, can you confirm that I'm coming through in this particular position?
Reasonably good in that position. Wait for the beeps and go right ahead.
Okay. So what you're saying regarding the noise makes sense, but it seems like because I've tested it out as well as the receive antenna, would that not also manifest the same noise, if not even more so than my random wire? Because I was able to pick up signals fairly clearly using the fire escape, where I was not able to do so using the random wire. Go ahead.
Now, whenever you change from antenna A to antenna B, slight difference in altitude, one vertical, one horizontal, one using the fire escape, one using the random wire, all of these different antennas have an entirely different antenna pattern in three-dimensional space. A simple dipole, if it was really out there in free space, gives you a pattern, if you could see it, that looks like a donut with the wire going down the center of the hole of the donut. And in the places where the donut is nice and fat, in those directions you're transmitting a strong signal. In the places where the donut is just a hole in the center, so to speak, along the piece of wire, collinear with the wire, you're transmitting very little signal. That's a simple dipole in free space. Now you take a monopole or a dipole near a building that's got metal structures inside, it's got wiring, it's got a conduit, it's got plumbing, it's got fire escapes, metal beams for support. It's got individual refrigerators and stoves and bathtubs and all kinds of things. You put that antenna in that environment and you just move the antenna a couple of feet one direction or the other. You could, in some cases, make a significant difference in the antenna pattern and whether or not the peaks or the valleys of the antenna pattern are looking at the strongest source of local noise, which maybe is a great big parking lot with a bunch of fluorescent lights, or maybe it's the local parkway with the sodium vapor lights. Who knows? But by taking a look with an oscilloscope to see if there is a 60-cycle stabilized component of the noise, it'll give you a hint. Most man-made continuous noise at 10 meters tends to have a 60-cycle component to it. Once you find out something about where it is, where it's coming from, you may be able to adjust the antenna to create a null in that direction, and therefore...
Repeater, timeout.
You may be able to create a null in that direction once you find out what it is, and therefore make an improvement, a huge improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. So where one of the antennas works better, that's very good. And it does suggest that local pattern and local sources of noise probably are the major cause of it, as I see it, Ed. And once you learn a little bit more about it by running a bunch of experiments, guarantee you'll find a way of making it better. And by the way, building a Yagi antenna to get a very highly directive pattern, even if it's only a three-element Yagi, two-element, three-element, four-element Yagi, have a coat hanger wire on 10 meters. It's difficult, but not impossible. People tend to use more larger pieces of tubing. But if you could get a pencil beam pattern aimed at your favorite repeater, I guarantee you get even more performance. That's just one of a number of ways to go. And it doesn't have to be expensive if you're willing to homebrew it. Over to you, Ed. And by the way, as you get further downrange to investigating this problem and finding a solution, or don't find a solution, please come back and tell us what you found so far. KC2PYT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, he's given me some food for thought. I'm going to tinker around and see what I can find out. Thank you very much for your help.
You're in a very good area, Ed. Where we amateurs shine the most is antenna tinkering. When it comes to Brazilian kinds of antennas, there's 5,000 kinds of antennas, and I'm not kidding. You open up the latest issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Jacek or Johnson or... I can't even think of the fourth guy's name, but you know what I mean. You'll find that there's 5,000 kinds of antennas, and we amateurs are extremely good at tinkering with them, finding variations, tilting it a little bit differently, zigzagging it differently, mounting it higher or lower, left and right, up and down, forward and back, and so on. Very few of us anymore, at least on 8 to 10 meters, build our own transmitters or build our own receivers, because with 1 week's salary, you can almost buy a Cadillac receiver. To build it with your own hands would take a year of your life, and you can't resell it. Whereas you buy a good brand name made by Southeast Asia, and if you don't like it a month from now, or a year from now, or 5 years from now, quite often you can get 75% of your money back by selling it to somebody else, as long as it's a respected brand and it's got a good track record. So we don't build our transmitters and receivers, but we do build our antennas. And you can save an awful lot of money, because some of the HF antennas, the compact ground plane-like things with all these fancy little coils and doodads on the side, let me drop them. Some of them sell for $200, $300, $400, $500. In some cases, they contain $50 worth of hardware. And if you're willing to homebrew it with the stuff that you own, you can do it for $25. So there's a lot of motivation from my point of view to build and tinker with antennas. Go for it. The next guy on our list was Joe, Kilo Delta 2, Echo Whiskey Oscar. Hope you're still there with us, Joe. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
KD2, Echo Whiskey Oscar. I do have a question while we're on antennas. Can you actually make an antenna? I've seen it done on YouTube. Can you actually make an antenna using the gutters of your home?
Oh, boy. Can you? Let me drop and get a beep. Any conductive object that exists in your environment, Joe, can be made into an antenna. And I'm not kidding. Any conductive object. In some cases, it doesn't even have to be conductive. In the case of a microwave poly rod antenna, a chunk of plastic at just the right shape can be an extremely high-gain antenna. But for HF frequencies, any conductor. There are law enforcement vehicles where the side view mirror is insulated from the rest of the car, and that is the antenna. There are other law enforcement vehicles where the rear speaker is a dual ridge waveguide type of an antenna, and it fires its signal up through the rear glass window of a car. The fender, where the fender joins the car, does two, that metal interface. Underneath the paint, you may not see it. There's a rubber seal there separating one from the other, and that becomes a dipole. So if you're smart enough, any piece of metallic conductor at HF frequencies can be made into an antenna. The first thing you're going to think about is, gee, how do I make something a half wavelength long when the wavelength is 132 feet for a half-wave dipole on 80 meters? How in the world can I do that? And if you're smart enough with the right kind of, give you an example. For instance, the so-called screwdriver antenna you can put on your automobile, manage to electronically shrink it real small. So can the metal gutters, can the downspout tubing? I, for instance, have used downspout spruce tubing from the gutters of my house. This is way back 20 years ago. I've used it as waveguide on the 3 gigahertz, on the 2 gigahertz ham band. So it can be used as transmission line. It can be used as an antenna. Lots and lots of ways. So if you're smart enough, you'd be amazed of all the 5,000 kinds of antennas, which you can do with a piece of sheet metal. One last question. At microwave frequencies, you can literally take a sheet of metal that's completely flat, pretty wide and pretty high, and cut notches in it, cut holes in it. And the holes you cut are in the form of dipoles, monopoles, X's, Y's, anchor symbols. There's all kinds of ways you can cut holes in the sheet metal, and you can construct something that's called a frequency selective surface. You can make that into an antenna, and you can make that into a phased array, an antenna with gain. So are there ways? Let me count the ways, if you know what I mean. There's lots and lots of them. KD2, Echo Whiskey Oscar, K2LIW.
K2LIW, thank you for that. I was thinking of doing some experimentation, but does the length of, I guess you got to get creative, does the length of the gutters matter as far as the what you can use and what frequencies you can transmit on?
Yes, it does. Now, that's the equivalent of saying, does the impedance of my antenna change when I take the 80-meter dipole, it should be 132 feet long, and I decide to make it 80 feet long, 60 feet long, 40 feet long, does the impedance change? Absolutely. By huge amounts. But it's predictable. It's deterministic. You go to the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, which you can find at the bottom of the page of the Tom Williams website, WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. You go to that website, you go to the bottom of the page where it talks about dipole and Yagi antennas by K2RIW. You'll find the two curves where any length of wire of any diameter, you can predict ahead of time exactly what the impedance is going to be. And by way of the Berkeley equation, by way of the Berkeley website, you can find out exactly what inductor and what capacitor will tune it to your particular frequency. In the case of downspout gutters, when you usually have pieces of gutter that are about, what, 6 feet long or so, or 8 feet long, and you telescope them together, let me drop. You got to worry a little bit about that interface where they telescope into each other. That could be kind of a scratchy contact. And maybe you've got to put a screw and a machine screw and or pop a rivet through there to make good contact. But should you use long pieces of downspout tubing or long pieces of gutter or short ones? Absolutely. All of the above. You'd be amazed how many guys have built a stealthy antenna on their house because the landlord wouldn't let them put an external antenna, and the gutter itself was the antenna. There's a number of amateurs who have done that. And so you got to worry a little bit about the joints, and each length requires a different tuning assembly. But what makes an antenna, the magic of what makes an antenna, is not necessarily the length. If you're lucky enough to make it exactly a half wavelength long, then impedance matching becomes easier. But at any length, you can resonate. Let me drop. What an antenna is, it's a low-loss resonator that's exposed to space. Let me repeat that. Every antenna is a low-loss resonator exposed to space. You resonate first, then it can radiate. Every antenna that we amateurs build, the highest priority we have is that structure, whether it's too long, too short, too high, too low, in the wrong environment, made of the wrong stuff. As long as you can force it into resonance, and if you're smart enough, you almost always can. If you make it resonate, it will radiate. If it doesn't radiate, it will not radiate. If it doesn't resonate, it will not radiate, with rare exception. And that exception happens to be a rhombic or a beverage antenna, one of these antennas where you make it a zillion wavelengths long. So as long as you're smart enough to make it resonate at your frequency, it will radiate, and 99% of the time, if you're smart enough, it'll radiate very well, even though you think the length is wrong. This is a controversial subject, I warn you. There were well-informed people on this repeater who disagree with that opinion. And we're in the process of running some more experiments on that one, as well as the transmission line experiment. So there are people who think that there are magic lengths of transmission line that make the Vizwire go away. We're reasonably sure that's not true. We're in the process of trying to prove it. But I've made lots of antennas in crazy environments where, let me drop. Because my client said, I've only got this number of cubic inches left over in this handheld device, and I want you to squeeze an antenna in there, and I want you to give me 90% efficiency out of that antenna at this particular frequency, even though the physical size inside that handheld device was way too short to make a normal length antenna. Can you do that if you're smart enough? Absolutely. So, as you can tell, it's just a matter of finding the right technique to resonate that structure, that metallic structure that you have discovered that can be made into an antenna. Every piece of metal with any reasonable conductivity can be made into an antenna. Go to it, Ed. KD2, Echo Whiskey Oscar, K2RIW.
Okay, Tempo, thank you for that, KD2, Echo Whiskey Oscar.
That was your only question, Ed. I thought that was your leading question. You had another one. And you got a couple. You're the last guy on the runway. If you want to ask another one, you've got the opportunity. Go ahead, Ed. I said Ed. I meant Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
No, that was my only question, and it's Joe. That was it?
Yeah, thank you, Joe. I corrected you, but I doubled with you. Alrighty. We're a little bit ahead of schedule. Rare. How about that, John? KC2WGB, those crazy guys that send you all these mind-bending questions. What have they sent you this week? And I hope you didn't get 283. I'm going to explain that to people. About 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, we got into some slightly controversial subjects. And 3 weeks ago, John, who collects the email, for people who want to ask questions. He had 283 emails. Hopefully he hasn't gotten that many, and we're not that much controversial this week. KC2WGB, K2RAWK, John.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net, and thank you for stopping by. Yep, got a question here, construction question. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on today. And the emails are back to normal. Thank God. That was a lot of reading. All right. This gentleman had a generator. I don't know what type, but the generator had an RF milliamp meter. And the meter is made by Weston, and it's labeled RF milliamp meter. He wants to know if he can install that in his existing generator, which does not have a milliamp meter. Now, his question is, it's a little convoluted inside to get the wiring done. Should he go ahead and punch out the frame and mount the meter, or is it all right if he built it into a separate box with the proper GR connectors to just slide it on? Would that work, and where are the minefields in that? If you could help him out with that, that's what he seems to need. He needs to be measuring the milliamperes from his generator. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, that's quite unusual. Let me pass it over to Hal. Hal, have you seen in some of the older pieces of equipment a milliamp meter telling you the RF output milliamperes? I think that's kind of rare in modern equipment, but maybe older equipment is done. Maybe it's only done up to 20 megacycles. I'm not sure. Let's see if Hal's got some experience on this one. K6DPZ, K2RAW in the tech net. Okay, Hal usually says he's got to leave us by 8:55, and maybe he has. I have seen an RF milliamp meter on very low frequency signal generators. It's kind of unusual, and there's a bunch of reasons why it's unusual. When it comes to measuring power output of a signal generator, quite a few signal generators will have a basic oscillator somewhere that runs, let me pick a number, 50 milliwatts. The 50 milliwatts goes into a step attenuator or piston attenuator, and therefore the power output is thoroughly adjustable with the attenuator, and all you're using the milliamp meter or millivolt meter for is to set a standard signal strength going into the attenuator assembly. So at the 50 milliwatt level, to put a milliamp meter or a millivolt meter, or it could be a rectifier system, which is acting as a voltmeter, but the dial and the meter itself is rated in milliamperes. But to set the standard signal going into the attenuator assembly, that makes some sense. Let me drop. However, since most receivers that you're likely to use today on almost any frequency, a real receiver connected to an antenna is usually measuring microvolts of signal. That's all that's coming out of the receiver. That's all that's coming into the receiver from the outside world. Microvolts. And if you now calculate into a 50-ohm antenna how many milliamps you get from microvolts, it's probably nanoamperes. You're not going to move the needle. So what I'm getting at is when you're... If you think that meter is telling you what is the real output from the signal generator going into your receiver under test, I doubt it. If it's being used to set the standard level at the... right at the master oscillator of the signal generator going into its attenuator, then that makes some sense. So I think it has limited usefulness. I think you better study a little bit more before you do it. You can't hurt anything by putting it into a separate box and running some experiments. But at the real signal levels at which you run a real receiver test to measure its sensitivity or to measure its intermodulation distortion, to make real receiver measurements, which usually are done in the microvolt region, I'm a little bit afraid that that needle is not going to move at the real output power. So I think you better do a little more study before you mess up the front panel on your main signal generator. That's my first suggestion on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I know what he means about that it's very complicated to try to put this in series with the output connection in the generator. But as you said, he could put that milliamp meter, being that it's an RF amp meter, it's made by Westcon, it's a good meter, he could put that in series with the input to the attenuator, and he would know at least how many milliamps are going into the attenuator, and knowing his output impedance, he should be able to calculate what's being delivered. I think that would work.
I agree with you, John. There are a number of Hewlett-Packard signal generators that do just that. They have a so-called reference setting, where you've got a number of knobs on the front panel where you're literally setting the power output of the oscillator. I mean, the particular oscillator on a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, for instance, the lowest frequency is 10 megacycles. The highest frequency, depending on which version, is 480 megahertz. That's a lot of octaves or decades in between. So therefore, just because you've tuned the oscillator to the new frequency doesn't mean you're going to get the same power output. You've got to set, you've got to reset the concentric knobs on the front panel that change the voltage or cathode bias or whatever. They're changing some of the parameters of the oscillator so that even though you've got it on the right frequency, you want to bring it up to a standard power. And therefore, they've got a meter from that oscillator directly into the attenuator. A number of the HPs have got that. But you can't use it to really measure power output at the microwave level. Your meter is not going to respond. You can't buy a meter sensitive enough to measure the nanoamperes that you're putting into your receiver when you're putting a microvolt of signal into it. They just don't make meters that sensitive. Oh, you and I could build one electronically, a whole lot of gain that builds up the signal before going into the meter, but to make a direct measurement at the real signal level, I think it's almost out of the question. So I think you got the idea there, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Dick, one other thought I have. Maybe he would be better off putting a tenth of an ohm resistor in series before the attenuator and just putting a little jack on the machine to dock his oscilloscope into. And he should be able to work that out. That should work for him. What do you think of that? Do you think he could run into any worse minefields?
With 10-to-1 scope probes, I think there would be no problem. And to do it correctly, the 1 ohm, 10 ohm, or whatever, or tenth of an ohm resistor that you choose, you really want to measure the differential voltage across it. To do that correctly, you wouldn't just put your scope probe there where you put the grounded lead on one end of the resistor and the scope probe hot lead on the other end of the resistor. Your grounded lead would be creating a considerable interference to the signal that wants to flow through the resistor. It really requires a pair of scope probes, and the scope has to be a dual channel scope where you're using it in the A minus B function in order to measure the voltage drop across that resistor. So can you do it that way? Yes. But you even there got to be a little bit careful. Otherwise, your scope probe hookup could disturb quite a bit what you're trying to do. You never want to take the RF signal and connect it directly to the grounded clip lead of a scope probe. Otherwise, the whole darn scope probe lead, the outer lead, becomes hot with RF. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Good answers. I think this helps them out a lot. Also, a lot of the new oscilloscopes have the differential inputs, so he should be able to do that if he has that available to him. But, well, at least he has an idea that he can't go wrong with putting on the outside or put on the inside. Just be careful. Evidently, it's a nice generator, but just no meter. And I agree with you. Most of them have microvolt meters, not microamp meters. So, well, we'll see what happens. Let me let it drop. I'll go into the next one.
Question. Go ahead with your question, Wes.
Intuition. Resonating frequency and being really said that antenna takes versus performance. It means in theory, and I would like you to correct me in that, you can have any piece of wire or metal resonating. resonating at any frequency as long as you are able to add the capacitive reactance